Hello, and welcome back to the H-Span Podcast, your go-to podcast for longevity policy discussion. I'm your host, Dylan Livingston. Today, we will be joined by Carl Flager, a super angel in the longevity field and one of the field's most prominent advocates. In this episode, I wanted to learn about Carl's background, how he made the leap from computer science at Google and Stanford to longevity enthusiast and investor. Without further ado, here's Carl Flager.
Live long and prosper.
All right, Carl Flager, thank you so much for joining the H-Span podcast. It's great to have you here.
Great to be here.
Anybody in the longevity industry knows Carl Flager. We at the H-Span podcast have a little bit different of an audience. So, Carl, can you introduce yourself? My title for you would be Longevity Super Angel. Yeah, that's what I have for you. But how do you introduce yourself?
Oh, I wouldn't put a title. Yeah, I'm an investor and advocate and I guess I'm slightly in media because of the website that I run, which we'll talk about.
Absolutely, yeah. Agingbiotech.info. Awesome. Carl, you have been involved with the longevity field for quite some time. Your entrance to the field has always fascinated me because you're not a typical biology. You didn't come from a biology background. I didn't either. Can you tell our audience a little bit how you got into longevity, your path from Stanford to Google to now being an investor and advocate in the longevity space? Can you give us the path?
Sure. So I'll give you the sort of 2 minute to 3 minute capsule history with, and then expand a little on the path into the field. I actually started studying artificial intelligence at Princeton in 1990, roughly, and specifically in studying neural networks, which of course now dominate the field. And then I went to Stanford to get a PhD. It got my PhD in computer science, but I studied very multi-cognitive science, neuroscience, and I thought for a while in my career that I was going to be a lifelong scientist studying the giant problem of human-level artificial intelligence. And it's interesting that has some interesting parallels with aging, which I'll talk about in a minute. But I was at Stanford in the 1990s when the internet exploded, and I saw that revolution, and I got involved in e-commerce. And so I decided that I would actually not go on to be a professor and instead went to Google. After I also did a brief stint at an e-commerce startup before that, before I got my PhD finished. And then I went to Google and I did practical big data, machine learning, and artificial intelligence, both in e-commerce and internet advertising for over a little over a decade. While we were at Google, of course, a lot of people made a lot of money. And some of the work I did in both e-commerce and internet advertising stretched a little bit into economics, which was interesting, sort of the economics of the internet and the way the money flows and the way how websites can be supported. When people made a lot of money, one of the things Google, to its credit, did was it decided that it should educate its employees about how finance works. And so a lot of us did a lot of self-education in that, but with some Nobel laureates brought in and things like that. And Google also, to its credit, started trying to improve the world. They created a philanthropic arm called Google.org. And one of the four prongs of that was for early on was global poverty reduction. And I spent 20% of my time for a couple of years working in that before they shut that program down. A couple of us actually, one or two of us were actually seriously considering leaving Google, going back and getting PhDs in economics to work on global poverty reduction, mostly in development economics. I actually thought I was going to do that for a few years. One of the approaches that Google takes very systematically a lot of the time is how to do the most good with the resources available. And there's a small thread in economics of how to improve the world the best with limited resources, which of course was limited resources, what economics is all about. That was pre the buzz phrase effective altruism, but there were early things in that direction, like this thing called the Copenhagen Consensus. And several of us were motivated by that. And as I was thinking about that, I learned all about aging biology and how some of the numbers that some of your earlier guests have already gone into, things like 70% of all deaths are caused basically directly by the molecular processes of aging. That's over 40 million people per year globally, over 100,000 people per day, every day. I think more than 120,000 people per day, over 90% of deaths in developed countries, basically directly traceable to the biology of aging. And but it can be interrupted. And from an effect, from a sort of most good that anybody can do per dollar of donation to charities or science, or per hour of their time, it was actually competitive with even helping the people who live on $2 a day avoid getting malaria and things like that. So I decided it was the more scientific thing to do. And it's interesting because the field of aging has a lot of interesting things in common with the field of artificial intelligence. Some parallels that I hadn't realized consciously until recently, but I think probably helped draw me to the field. Artificial intelligence is a gigantic scientific problem, super interesting, one of the most interesting scientific problems of our time. And the same thing is true of aging and how to interfere with it and fix it and reverse it. There's a bunch of other interesting parallels, like the fact that both have an interesting existence proof. In AI, the existence proof is people's brains. Mm-hmm. People are intelligent. The whole idea is, can we replicate that intelligence in other artificially created devices? In aging, the existence proof is there are species that do not seem to age, that whose risk of death does not go up the longer they've been on the planet since their birth. And yet it's not necessarily an easy problem to figure out how to replicate that in a different species. Another interesting parallel is that people have, from the very beginning of the field, of both fields, in AI, they've argued about what the nature of intelligence actually is. The main goal is this thing that actually there's a lot of debate amongst the biggest experts in the world of what actually it is. And some people say we have to exactly understand it and come to full understanding before we can really make good progress. And other people just go ahead and make progress. And we can now see in AI that huge amount of progress has been made, and yet there are still debates. And of course, we understand a lot better what intelligence is compared to what we understood 50 years ago, but there's still debates, and some of the same debates that happened decades ago. And yet there's been an amazing amount of progress. And I think the same thing will probably happen in aging. There's huge debates about what exactly is aging. And some people are skeptical about the amount of progress we can make without actually getting more progress on answers to those questions and consensus. And other people think that probably we'll actually make good progress. And of course, more understanding is better in both cases. And probably the most important thing is that both are very permeated by a sense of revolution, like that this is a huge thing that's really going to change the world. And it's super, super important. It's very critical. And I think we're starting to see that real change in the world with AI. But people in the 70s, in the 80s, a lot of people had that feeling, and I got it in the 90s, in starting the very early 90s, based on the work in the 80s. And I think that we're starting to see that now. And within the aging field, all the top experts in the world also have this sort of, we're in this to change the world, and it's going to be a really big change for the better. And most people don't realize how big a revolution it's going to be. And that same feeling permeates this field that I saw even a generation before in AI. And in some senses, AI is a generation ahead in its stage, I think, compared to aging and longevity.
Those are some fascinating parallels that I never thought of. You could probably extend it also to other kind of next gen scientific developments. Kind of, like, I'm thinking Tesla, right? Like a big fan base of and believer in the technology led to it being created. Same with OpenAI, right? There were really smart people who believed back in 2010 to make this happen, right? It's the same thing that's going on in aging biology. I would say we're a little later, though. I do agree with you, but biology is
I wrote a thread on Twitter. On X now, there's a long detailed thread where I went over 12 or something parallels. It was once I started listing, I was like, wait a minute, this is more than I realized, and I listed them. So I gave you the highlights, but anybody who wants to can go find my Twitter or my X account and check out that thread on AI versus aging parallels.
Yeah, I will definitely check that out myself. I did not see that. What's your, I usually do this at the end. What's your Twitter handle?
It's just at like everybody, and then my first name, then my last name. So KARLPFLEGER.
All right. Carl's a good follow. Definitely follow him, everybody. But so to go back to, I have a few questions on how you said in 2012, when was the year when you really had that realization about how the impact of aging or getting involved?
Yeah, it was about 2011 to 2012. I looked around at Google to see if there was something I could convince Google to get into this area, but it was pre-Calico, Verily, and they weren't really ready yet. So I left officially in 2013. I was planning to leave starting in 2012, but I had things to tie up and left in 2013, not trained. My education's not biology. So for a while, I just did philanthropy. networking and learned the biology on the side. And then I officially got into investing in 2017. I realized that was probably a good idea in 2016. So ramped up, you know, made sure I understood what I was doing and started actually deploying capital in 2017 to expand the set of capital available for science. So more good studies got done and also ramped up my education, which is great. And then I created the website, which we'll talk about started in 2018, launched it in 2019.
Yeah, the website I will say has come in handy many times for me just navigating this field. So we'll get into that in a sec, but I just want to comment on, if you got involved in 2017, it feels just looking at your website and just looking at the internet, most of the companies in this space, or at least the more mature companies in this space, got started around 2015, 2016, 2017, like the ones that are ahead in the clinical trial process and raising funding and all that.
Yeah, so Kristen Fortney and I had coffee in 2016 when she had gotten one check of investment for BioAge. And that was my trigger. I was like, okay, yeah, I should probably invest in companies like this. And so I missed that one because I decided not to jump in before I really looked and thought about investing and how best to do it. I delayed about a half a year or more. I was actually trying to figure out for a little while before I started angel investing, whether I could create a charitable foundation and have the charitable foundation do the investing in order to pay less tax on the gains from the winners to the government and instead recycle that money to help the field more. So my original idea was put a bunch of money in a charitable foundation, have the charitable foundation invest in biotech startups. And then when it has winners, immediately reinvest in more biotech startups and keep all that money in a charitable pot. Because that's all I had been doing so far in the field was charity. And it turned out that for various tax reasons and legal reasons, it's very hard to do that. And I'm happy to have a conversation with people about that, but that's probably too detailed for this podcast.
I have, in my A4LI time, have become more learned about tax exemption statuses and nonprofit setup and all that kind of stuff. So we could probably have a conversation about it, but I think that's maybe not the conversation that our listeners are expecting.
But so your point was that a lot of companies started that the early companies started around.
Yeah, exactly.
One of the ones leading the charge. Trickle before that, but then it's grown every year since then.
And it's shocking how few companies were around before like that 2015, 2016 mark. Very few, right?
So my first couple of years in the field, besides just donating money and going to conferences and events, one of the things that I did, Joe Betz-Lacroix had done some of this as well, is tried to create events in order to connect biologists who didn't have a normal habit of starting companies from academia, the PhD students, the postdocs, even the professors, with the people from Silicon Valley, the entrepreneurs, the tech people, the venture folks, to get more company creation going. Because I think there was a sense that the grant money was not growing as fast as it should, but there was this pot of venture money and we just needed more biologists to get the sort of instincts that the computer science people and the other tech engineer people had of starting a company when there was a good stage for ready for commercialization. And so that was something I did for a few years, and there were a few embryonic efforts that helped create some companies but never really got legs. And eventually people like Nathan Chang rebooted this as a virtual thing. We were trying to create these in-person events in the San Francisco Bay Area. Then what's now Longevity Biotech Fellowship came along as a virtual version of that kind of connecting process. Right. And I think that's now got legs and it's going, which is good.
Yeah, the advocacy space, and I think A4LI is definitely part of this, but the advocacy space definitely has matured a bit since that 2017 time too. Can you make a comment on what you've really seen? Are the companies being spun out now more than 2021? Like, when was the peak in the last 7 years? Is it really picking up as much as we think, or is it pretty evenly distributed over the 7 years with how do you see it? As
it's definitely just growing, right? I don't know if my video is going to be flipped, but it's very much up and to the right. Whether it's concave or convex is hard to say. I'd say it's accelerating, so it's more like an exponential. There might have been a little bit of a hiccup in COVID times, especially or in that 2022 kind of stock market crashed, which caused a lot of funding to dry up. But overall, the number of companies getting started has basically from 2017 on just gone up and up. And I have a graph on the website, where I did for a while, of I started the website. One of the goals was to track this kind of thing of like how the field is growing by being able to snapshot things over time. But one of the interesting things that you can do, even when you just come along at any instant, if you then get a list of companies, is most of the companies you can find out when they were founded. So then you can go back. And once you have a reasonably comprehensive list of companies, you can go back and plot how many companies were founded every given year. And when I did that, it was very much up and to the right. Okay. I think the last time I looked at that was 2021 or something like that. But it's definitely been more and more companies being founded every year. And now I can barely keep up with even adding them to a list, let alone looking at each one in detail. So A lot of them are coming along.
That was going to be one of my next questions. We'll get to that in one more sec. But I have one more question about how you got into this space. In 2012, 13, the figures that are in the field today that are big and prominent probably had half or a quarter of them as prominent figures 10 years ago. A lot of new figures have shown up over the last 12 years. Who got you into, what would you have any like names you can drop, any scientists that you that really drew you to this, or company? So
it was primarily three things. For Joe Betz-Lacroix had been running these what were called health extension salons, which are basically these in the Bay Area on the San Francisco Peninsula, these in-person 3-hour events, which were like socializing and some food and drink, and then a talk by some prominent person, sometimes preceded by a sort of warm-up app. So oftentimes it was like a professor level talk, maybe a postdoc or PhD level talk before that, sometimes a company, less the companies in the early stages. And there was a sense that most of the people who came to those were people who were really driven by the mission of the field. And he would give motivational speeches. So I went to a couple of those. I thought they were very good. I actually wrote a paper with him. He and Kristen Fortney and Yanni Donner and a few other people had a paper in the works. And then when I started coming to those, and it was a survey of people wanting to live longer if you actually specify that they'll be in good health rather than them thinking about they're going to be decrepit like their grandparents. And I had a way to do survey data separately from Google. And I joined as an author because I replicated their initial survey and made the paper a little bit stronger. It's a nice 2-page paper. Great Desire for Something is the title. Great Desire for Longer Lifespan or something. And then, those groups, and Kristen Fortney was one of the people who went to those regularly. I think one of the first ones I saw was Judy Campisi talking about cellular senescence and her whole overview of cancer and aging. And I read Aubrey de Grey's book, and many people, that was a big part of getting me into the field. I thought he laid out the moral case very well. And that chapter of that book is one of the key items in the sort of list of half a dozen things that I think are the best motivations and justifications for the field, which is on the website. I had been nudged to read that book, know who Aubrey was, and go to that event of Joe's by a friend and a couple other people I knew at Google who knew about that world and were into it and knew about calorie restriction. And one of them, a guy named Michelangelo, had been part of the Calorie Restriction Society. And so at one point I went to a Calorie Restriction Society meeting, and there's a lot of interesting people there who like to practice eating low calorie, but also follow the science greatly. And so that was a third angle in. And then when I knew from that this was a valid field, just from an economic effective altruistic aspect of things, one of the obvious places to charitably donate money was the Buck Institute, which of course is up here in north of San Francisco. And so that was one of my earliest charitable recipients that I donated to regularly. And they did a really good job as a whole institute. Brian Kennedy was in charge at the time. People, other big professors, so Judy Campisi, I mentioned, was there. Gordon Lithgow was there. Simon Miloff was there. So they ran a lot of events for their donors to help educate them about the science. So that whole collection of professors and that whole institute was the other main thing that got me into the field and got me doing more than just writing checks, but also really participating and helping to grow my network and educate me, and then get me to help want to give back by running events and then investing. And so that's a smorgasbord of what got me into the field.
And then now educating the rest of us, right, with agingbiotech.info, which we've mentioned a number of times. I definitely want to touch on.
So I came in as a person who was educated in a different discipline. In fact, quite a lot of computer scientists come into the aging field. And so I knew what it was like to try to ramp up knowledge. And so that was partly colored how I approach how I'm giving back to the community as well.
Absolutely. Yeah. So yeah, tell us a little bit about agingbiotech.info. I have specific questions about it. And we mentioned before, or you mentioned before, that we're at the point now where it's hard to keep track of all the companies that are joining. So first, can you just tell the audience a little bit about agingbiotech.info? And then my specific question is, what criteria defines what a how a company makes?
So the origin story here is that I started investing in companies. And since I was investing in companies, every time I went to an event or saw a post or a news story that mentioned a company I didn't know about, I just added it to a list. And I thought, okay, at the time when I started investing, there weren't that many companies in the field. And I decided I was going to invest very narrowly. I was going to have these blinders and not invest in every cancer startup or everything in health and medicine. I was just going to invest in aging, biology, longevity, rejuvenation. And there were only, as far as I had heard about, there were a couple dozen companies, maybe. You could see all these articles written about, you know, here are the 20 companies in this field or whatever. And it was mostly about the academics. And so every time I learned about a company, I thought, oh, I'll add it to this list. And at some point, I should go over and look at what each one of these is doing and decide whether I want to invest in them. And pretty soon, after about a year of not really trying to find every corner of the world, my list of companies was about 100 companies. And I kept reading these, talking to people who were the experts in the field, professors at the Buck and other places, people who've been in venture for a long time. And every one of them seemed to think there were only 20 companies or something like that. Or you'd see these articles and they talk about the two dozen companies or the top 15 companies, and there's only a few others. And I was like, people don't realize how fast the field is growing. And it turns out sort of the investors who were most knowledgeable about the field really understood. And most investors have their own internal database of companies, but they just keep that to themselves. And I realized the whole reason I got into the investing part was to help advance the field and make everything go faster. And so I thought one of the things I should do is just open source my list of companies instead of just keeping it to myself. And instead of just making it a list, I should make it more of a database, more of a table that has useful information quickly summarized about each company so people can quickly sort the list the way they want and figure out which parts of the space they want to concentrate on. And then it would be a useful way to track the progress of the field as it grows by, for example, one of the columns that I have for every company is the number of employees working at that company. How much money have they raised? What phase of clinical trials are they in? So all of those are ways that you can then track over time the progress as the field advances, that both the companies grow and each company on average gets bigger or goes to a later stage. And at the time, the other aspect of things I was seeing in the field as it grew was there was more and more written about the field. There was an increasing number of books written about the field. There was an increasing number of blogs about the field. There was just more, and slightly more news articles. But all of these were blobs of prose, right? They were just, it's hard to read paragraphs and paragraphs of prose. It's hard to quickly find the information you need. This was long before LLMs or any kind of automatic summary. And I decided what the field needed was actually a resource that was more structured, less prose, more database or table. And so that was an overriding philosophy in creating this website. So at first, the website was just a giant list of all of the biotech startups within the aging longevity sector. And showed people at the lifespan.io conference in New York in 2019, I can't remember if it was 2018 that I first showed the embryonic ones, and then I launched it in 2019. I think that's correct. And it was about 100, I think I had 120 companies on my to-be-processed list, and I had done 70 of them, and I launched it with 70 or 80, and then quickly got the rest up there, and it was 120 then. And over time, that's grown to 300-400 companies. And at first, it was just a list of companies. And the criteria for this was an important part of creating this list was what exactly is the entrance criteria? Because I didn't want mission creep of scope I didn't want to encompass every single biotech startup. And I didn't want it to be, the whole point of the aging field is that there are molecular processes that underlie biological aging that happen to everyone as they age that as a whole together contribute to and directly cause all age-related chronic diseases. That includes all the top killer diseases, cancer, heart disease, Alzheimer's, diabetes, et cetera, plus all the ones that don't kill you, like osteoarthritis and osteoporosis that make life bad and age-related blindness. And that sort of it's these shared molecular aspects of aging that cause all those diseases. So I don't consider, and most people don't consider, that the single disease type approaches, right? If it's just a disease specific pathology that's downstream of all those other things, and then you interfere with that and it might help with the disease, but it doesn't help any of the other diseases. It's called the geroscience hypothesis, the idea that if you interfere with those aging processes, you'll actually have efficacy mitigating all the different diseases. And so that was the underlying philosophy for the entrance criteria for what counts as an aging company on the website. It's so that in the website of URL, we've mentioned it, but let me say it again, it's agingbiotech.info. And so agingbiotech.info/companies is the big list of companies. And there's an about page. So agingbiotech.info/about, and there's a header on the top that you can navigate between all these things. The about page has several sections. One of the sections is why is it the field important? But one of the sections is what counts as aging for the purpose of this website. And so that lays out the criteria to directly answer your question in specific detail. But basically the overriding philosophy there is geroscience hypothesis. So if the company's trying to address fundamental aspects of aging that should therefore mitigate multiple age-related chronic diseases, then it goes in the list. If it's a single disease company, then it doesn't. And if it's doing things that aren't particularly related to aging, just because it's health or medicine, that does not necessarily make it aging. And cancer is a collection of diseases or a category of diseases. The oncology field is gigantic and that dominates biotech right now. So I explicitly remove that from scope, even though cancer is an age-related disease, because the whole point of the aging longevity field is that we're going to cure or prevent cancer by attacking aging directly and get all the other benefits as well. And so So cancer companies are explicitly out, unless their cancer programs are just a side effect of the other more general mechanism of actions. So that's roughly the origin story, the fact that the company's table was the thing that started, and the criteria for the company's table. And that's roughly the criteria for all the other tables. Now, what happened is, after I initially created that, the website has in the last few years expanded. And so where it was originally meant to be just a list of the companies in the space and a way to track the progress of the space, because of course, everything important, there's a lot of science that's really important that's going on in academia. In order for anything important that we discover, that the world of the humanity discovers about aging, in order for it to actually benefit millions of people, it's going to have to go through being in a company and getting a product on the market. Right. And so the whole reason to start with companies and focus on companies as the main unit is that's how you track the progress of the field actually creating the benefits for humanity, that's saving millions of lives, which is the important thing. But over time, I realized it was useful to help bring more people into the field and help educate investors in and all kinds of other, there's many use cases, to expand the set of information that's summarized in a structured way on the website. And so the website now has something like 20 different tables on it. They're all tables. Every one of the tables, like the company's table, has columns that can be sorted. Every sort by any column, you can restrict or filter by any of the columns. So there's a list of the best books, a list of the best podcasts, which this podcast, of course, is on, a list of the best blogs, a list of the best conferences to go to, the list of clinical trials, a list of common objections to the field and their counterarguments, like the fact that the field won't cause overpopulation. The broad mission has basically expanded to be to organize everything about the field that isn't in academia and make it, summarize it and structure it in such a way that it's quickly able to find pieces of information and click a link off to get more details and the most up-to-date information to see if what's reflected on the website is out of date or not.
I can attest to how useful it is. I have been on, I think when you put A in the search bar, it goes not to a4li.org, it goes to agingbiotech.info on my computer here. That's how much I go on the site. I can't believe I've never seen the about section though. I guess I'm mostly on the companies and the investors and nonprofits pages. But everybody, you should definitely go check it out. A question completely not related to agingbiotech.info popped into my head when you were talking. I guess it's somewhat related, but so in terms of defining a therapeutic as or a company as an age-related or a company or sorry, I'm scratch this part out. For example, Ozempic, right? We're starting to see potential data that something like may have effects on more than just diabetes and weight loss, and could have potential effects on Alzheimer's. I think I might have seen heart disease potentially. And so where does Ozempic fall? Is Ozempic a longevity slash aging drug, even if it doesn't necessarily play on the agreed upon pathways of aging?
I don't know if how much my views are a minority view here, but my view on this is definitely different than some people's. Obesity, so we know that one of the first things the field discovered is that the rate at which the molecular changes that underlie aging don't proceed like an atomic clock at a fixed rate. That you can, there, it's mutable or malleable, right? That's the whole point that started the field, right? We can interfere with those processes, and there are known things that cause those processes to run slower or faster. And of course, the whole, one of the large fraction of the effort of the field is trying to make those things run slower. And right, the field partially started with the idea that calorie restriction, the earliest intervention that we found was that calorie restriction would make various animals live longer. And it, essentially it's making those animals live longer by running some of the biochemistry of normal life more slowly, and therefore the problems that build up over time as a result of those chemical reactions happen more slowly. There are other things that you can do to make those things run faster and therefore age faster. And predictably, the opposite of calorie restriction, excess calories or overeating, and leads to obesity, and that leads to faster aging. My view is that weight loss drugs like the GLP-1 drugs essentially slow aging only so much, only in the sense that they reverse or cure or rescue the sped up aging caused by overeating. So anything you do to reduce obesity should slow aging relative to the obese state. The question is, do those drugs, or does anything else that you do to reduce obesity, have some other biological mechanism of action that would work even for lean subjects or animals?
Right.
So far, there's no data to suggest that GLP-1 drugs would help lean people. So to me, they're not aging drugs. They're more like cures for a poison that speeds up aging, right? I think of it as, imagine a sort of snake venom that if you took it at the right small dose every day, it wouldn't completely kill you, but it would make you a tiny bit sicker and therefore shorten your life. But somebody had an antidote for that. Was that antidote an anti-aging drug for the people who are drinking the snake venom poison? For those people, yes, it would. You could view it that way, but it wouldn't help somebody 100 years ago who wasn't drinking the snake venom, or even somebody today who wasn't. I think it's these GLP drugs are great because they're helping a large class of people who are suffering bad health effects, but I don't consider them to be aging drugs. To me, to be an aging intervention, it has to help everybody. It's the molecular biology that affects all of us that is what we're trying to slow or reverse. The reason the GLP-1 drugs have this evidence that you mentioned against Alzheimer's and against cardiovascular disease is because when you trial it in a population of people randomly selected from the overall population, a large fraction of them are overweight and therefore have this sped up aging. And so if you're reversing it, that effect, that acceleration of aging in enough of the study cohort, then you get an average effect that's beneficial.
Yeah. Yeah. If evidence came out, or I can't imagine they would run a trial with only lean people. I feel like that's probably not. Right.
They're not likely to do that.
Yeah. Unless maybe something made for LI can help with. But anyways, I saw an article in the New York Times the other day about the Ozempic's potential effect on multiple age-related diseases. And I figured that was a good question to ask. So I like the answer. Ozempic, not on the agingbiotech.info list. It's not an aging drug, but has
the
potential.
And, you know, but the list of companies wouldn't have it anyway, because it's a drug, not a company. So then the question is, do the companies that are pretty well, the companies that are doing it are these big pharma companies, right? Big pharma companies aren't on the list either. the companies on the list are the ones that are whose main programs are going after age-related things. Big pharma companies are just these giant companies that have many different drugs for many different non-age-related conditions and some age-related conditions, but it's different drugs for each condition. So for the most part, at the moment, big pharma is not going after aging and longevity yet. It's at least not a big effort. But even then, I'm probably not going to try to, you can't really see inside the big companies very well from a public information point of view. There is a separate table on the website just released last week called agingbiotech.info/therapeutics. And so that's where the individual drug classes will go. And I think I can't remember if I have the GLP-1 drugs on there. I think I might have the GLP-1 drugs on there because that's where the debates can be about, is it really an aging drug or not? And that's the table that's about link to the data and let people decide.
I'm taking a look at the therapeutic section now. I'll take a look at it more. It's brand new. Yeah, this wasn't here last week. So I want to talk to you a little bit about pharma, because that's an interesting point. Companies like we discussed BioAge before, BioAge has, I think, multiple deals with pharma companies, Eli Lilly, I think, but Eli Lilly definitely. Fauna, I think, I can't think of all of them off the top of my head, but we're seeing more of these partnerships form between big pharma and these startups, maturing startups in the space.
The growing maturity of the field.
It's a sign, exactly. So I guess my question really is, how do you see this interacting with big pharma? Are we going to be seeing the way that Moderna and BioNTech came out of nowhere when the COVID crisis happened? Are we going to see like a Moderna-esque rise from companies in the space? Or do you think this is going to be more like a companies grow to get incorporated to or become a division of a big pharma company? Like, how do you see this kind of progressing? Do you have any thoughts on that?
I think all of those and straight acquisitions and pharma is going to start incorporating programs in-house as well. I think you can see all of this, right? So let me say a few things that dance around your question, and then you can zoom in on what I haven't answered. Many of the companies, the traditional biotech that pharma snaps up in the past, are single asset plays where there's a particular piece of academic work on a certain pathway, and then you try to figure out how to target it. And then that becomes a drug program that gets spun out into a biotech, and it either works or it doesn't. It gets acquired by biotech and it gets absorbed into their mass umbrella program. A lot of the companies in the aging space, not all, but a lot of them have platforms where they have some interesting, and there's platforms in biotech long before this too, but a lot of the companies in the space, BioAge is one, Fauna is another, since you mentioned it, have these platforms that are capable of spinning out many different drugs, but there's something about the platform that lets them generate new drug candidates, even in different areas. A common kind of platform in the aging field is having some kind of a screen on lifespan. You get a bunch of worms, like nematode worms, C. elegans, or fruit flies, or in some cases, other species, and you look at what molecules make those live longer. And then that way you could possibly have many different leads, and they might all have different areas of effect. So one of the things that happens in companies that are desperate for money because they're startups is that sometimes the early leads, in order to generate money to live longer, they'll license out or do deals with pharma for the early leads to generate revenue and also mind share, the validation for the platform. And so that's one form of partnership that's happening a lot right now. Another concern many people in the field have is that oftentimes when a startup gets bought, a lot of times the startup gets bought for their lead program and the platform gets put on a shelf and never used again and lost to the stops generating benefit for humanity. So a lot of people in the field who started companies who are very mission oriented are trying to guard against that by instead spinning out subsidiaries that will get acquired with specific lead programs or doing these licensing deals. And so that's a big issue that's going on in the field for a lot of the companies at the moment. So I see a lot of, I think what's going to happen is we've seen a few acquisitions already in the field where bigger companies have snapped up some of the startups. There's a tab for acquired on the company's list on the website, but that's more of that's going to come. But there's also going to be more licensing deals. And there will be more outright, there will be both the acquisitions where somebody spins off a sub-asset and the acquisition where the pharma acquires the whole thing. And we're also starting to see deals where most of the big pharmas have their own venture arms. And we're starting to see deals where a big pharma's venture arm will lead an investment round instead of it being an independent VC fund, lead an investment round in a Series A or a Series B for some of the companies in the space. So that's another form of interaction. And then what I think will happen, and I think we're on the verge of this, and maybe it's happening already, but we just don't see it because we don't see the internals of the pharma as much publicly, is that pharma is going to start having lots of their own internal work. And at this point, when I started, it wasn't really on the radar. At this point, I hear that there are many groups within a lot of the big pharma companies studying senescent cells in detail and a few other areas that are well-known aging hallmarks or pathways. And of course, GLP-1 drugs are very big right now, and weight loss drugs in general. The fact that the GLP-1 drugs cause muscle loss is causing the muscle area, which was a kind of a backwater of biotech maybe 3+, 4+ years ago, a lot of failed stuff in muscle and nobody really thought of much of it. But because the GLP-1 drugs are causing muscle loss along with the weight loss, which is unsurprising, right? If you don't exercise that much and you're obese and you start taking a drug that causes you to eat less, but you don't also increase exercise, then you lose a lot of muscle along with fat. But there are many companies in the space. I actually did a roundup of them on both X and LinkedIn a while back, of the companies in muscle indication clinical trials or late preclinical. I think that interest from pharma on avoiding the muscle loss and pairing a GLP-1 drug with a muscle boosting drug is going to cause a lot of the companies that have been working on age-related muscle decline to really have much more deal making with pharma. So I think there's either going to be acquisitions for that, or there's going to be a lot of partnerships.
Right.
And we're seeing that already. A lot of the companies that have muscle programs in clinical or late preclinical are getting a lot of interest from in terms of for partnerships at the moment.
Right. The one that comes to mind is BioAge.
So BioAge has a muscle atrophy drug in phase 2 clinical trials. Immunis is another one that has a muscle atrophy drug. It's going after a different indication. They're in phase 1/2A. So they have basically a phase 1 with some early 2A readouts. And there's other companies in the roundup that I did. There's about 6 to 8 of them, I recall, that I rounded up, I think, 1.25 years ago at this point.
Yeah, that seems to be the hot topic right now, for sure. Just riding off of the Ozempic wave, right?
And there are also age-related changes to metabolism. So there are a lot of companies that are pivoting because of the Ozempic and GLP-1 broader craze. There are a lot of aging companies that are working on obesity plays now.
Fascinating. So I'm not going to be able probably to get to every question I wanted to ask you here, but I do want to talk about one specific belief that you hold, a little bit about your kind of investing philosophy here. You've said on X and LinkedIn many times, I've seen at least, that you are a believer in or bullish on rejuvenation technologies versus technologies that just mitigate the effects of aging or slow aging. So can you talk about why that's your philosophy? And does that translate perfectly to your investment portfolio, or all the companies that you invest in specifically rejuvenation based, or is there some mix based on other factors?
Okay, so my preference for rejuvenation over age slowing has two aspects. One is just what the goal is, and the other is there's a sort of embedded prediction in there. So the what the goal is part is that I want to help the most people as much as possible, and age slowing is much, much better. And I'm in all complete agreement with everybody in the field who favors that approach in terms of that still being much better than the current state of healthcare and the way clinical medicine is currently practiced, of waiting till the diseases get full-blown clinical stage, and which is a little bit too late. So all of the people in the field are in agreement that's the model that has to be replaced with something that really attacks aging, and slowing aging approaches are still much better than that. The problem with slow aging approaches is that you can only slow aging to a certain extent. You can't fully halt it and still be living. So if you're already old, then slowing your rate of aging doesn't really get you any better function. It doesn't restore any of the younger, the beneficial biology that you had when you were a young adult. And in terms of how long it keeps you alive, it doesn't really extend it that much. So slow aging approaches are most helpful to the people who are reasonably young. So it'll help future generations. It'll help people who are midlife maybe and a little bit young and young adult. But the people who are already old, I'd like to help them too. So you need rejuvenation for that, right? So you need the ability to change molecular state back to the way it was at younger, closer to the way it was in young adulthood. So that's just a basic goal in terms of how much can help. You can also, the degree of healthy life, the healthy lifespan that you can add to somebody's life is greater if you can rejuvenate them, obviously. The idea is you can do it repeatedly. So that's the sort of goal-based aspect. There's also a bit of a prediction. So right now, I'd say about a third of the field is focused on rejuvenation, and about two-thirds of the field is focused on, this is this rough, vague, rounded to the nearest third. So two-thirds is focused on slow aging. Slow aging is a little bit easier in some sense. There are many ways to interfere with the basic biochemistry of metabolism that causes it to slow down or speed up. And once you identify one of those, you can poke it in the right direction. The problem with that is, and of course, then it's easy also because you can have monotherapies, right? You can have a single drug that has that effect. The problem with that is that it's a very complicated mass metabolism, and all these different ways to poke it, a lot of them get at the same things. And so we already know that just lifestyle, like, you know, how much you eat, as we talked about earlier, but also how much you exercise and sleep and not smoking or abusing other pharmaceutical substances like alcohol, can affect your rate of aging. And it turns out that humans, the best data available epidemiologically seems to suggest that humans can affect their overall lifespan by about 10 to 20 years by just doing the right lifestyle choices. And that's within the margin of error for what we think is the best effect size for any of these kinds of drugs, rapamycin or metformin or GLP-1 drugs. It's not clear that if you just don't eat too much and exercise enough and don't get sleep deprived regularly and don't abuse any substances, it's not clear if any of the things we have currently really get you much more than that. And we know that if you look at how much lifespan extension you get in different species, as the species get longer lived, the degree of lifespan extension for any given intervention that does work across species gets less. And so I think that a lot of people believe that we're going to only get 1% or 5% or 10% better with anything that we produce in the slow aging approach in the next several years, many years. Now, reversing aging is going to be harder in some sense because you have to reverse many different molecular processes. It's more of a divide and conquer approach. You have these well worked out molecular changes, and then we have to figure out biotech ways to interfere with those molecular changes. And we don't know ways to reverse a lot of them, but we know ways to reverse many of them. And many of those, like killing senescent cells, are in clinical trials already or in late preclinical. And so I'm very excited about many of these different areas of killing senescent cells, epigenetic reprogramming, et cetera. And if we layer together enough of these different molecular reversals, then I think we'll get, in the long run, better overall progress in the field. And yes, my personal investing tries to be almost exclusively focused on these rejuvenation things. Sometimes it's hard to tell when I invest in a company that has a sort of pretty general platform that might generate interventions in either style, but I hope that they'll generate more of the rejuvenation ones. The majority of my portfolio is made up of companies where there's a particular molecular change that accumulates with aging, and the therapeutic is attempting to specifically poke that molecular change back to, you jump it back to closer to the way it was in young adulthood in a short-term intervention, which you can then reapply infrequently, but periodically. And that's the sort of majority of my portfolio.
You talked about reprogramming, you talked about senescent cells. Are those the two kind of areas you're most bullish on? What else?
Those are the two areas. They'd probably be the top two on my list. And then the next couple would be stem cell secretions. So we know if you give secretions from stem cells or you inject the stem cells themselves and let them secrete in vivo, you can rejuvenate stem cells that are already in the body that are old, then that helps with wound healing and muscle growth. And so that's another one there. The mechanism of the molecular change is less clear. I think they're effectively doing epigenetic reprogramming in the aged stem cells, but that's not yet shown. Another one is atherosclerotic plaque reversal. So there's a couple companies. That's the number one killer. For all that cancer and oncology dominates biotech and pharma, atherosclerosis and cardiovascular disease are actually the top killer. And all of the current treatments, all of the cholesterol-lowering drugs, the PCSK9s, the statins, aren't really disease-reversing. They just slow the progression. But there's a couple companies that have grown out of this field. In some ways, this feels a little more single disease, but really the vasculature stuff also affects dementia. That accumulation of plaque, the molecular accumulation of plaque in the arteries, can actually be reversed. And so there's a couple of companies working on that. Those are the four areas I've done multiple shots on goal with. There's a whole bunch of others that meet this idea of there's a molecular change. So there's ones that are working on barrier functions, for example, blood-brain barrier or leaky gut, and trying to fix that, ways to remove crosslinks in extracellular matrix, things like that.
Yeah, from a...
ECM is probably my next big...
What did you say?
ECM, fixing the extracellular matrix, probably my next big one. That probably goes as fourth or fifth.
I definitely, as someone who wants to live longer, I would like to see the rejuvenation, live longer in a good state of health. I think for most people alive today, a slowing aging drug isn't as effective as it otherwise would be if it was rejuvenation. So I'm on board with that too. I'm on board with your general thesis there. I have one more final question for you before we wrap up here. And it goes at the challenge. It's a question about the challenges that this field faces today. So there are a number of hurdles, right? There are a number of bottlenecks. There's probably a different panel in the field every day every week about bottlenecks. It's a very talked about topic. What do you think the number one bottleneck in this field is? And do you have any solutions to fix that bottleneck?
Obviously, the one that everybody talks about the most is funding. And I think that's really true. The other half of the other obvious one is the regulatory aspect. So the funding is a harder one to say how to fix. So let me talk about the regulatory aspect. But first, let me just say, funding-wise, this is the big thing that matters the most, right? Is getting the mentality away from the traditional way that clinical medicine is practiced at treating diseases when they come up. The analogy here is cars, right? Everybody realizes that you can't just drive a car until something falls off or it stops working completely and then take it to the mechanic, right? That's not as good as going to the mechanic regularly to have the oil changed and to figure out if there's a particular part that's worn too much or to scrape the rust off every now and then before the actual fender completely falls off. But yet the way we deal with human bodies is essentially more analogous to the driving the car until the parts fall off or it just falls over on the side of the road. We need that mentality shift so that things like the way the NIH is structured isn't all about the diseases, but it's about the molecular processes that go on. There should be an NIH for the rusting that happens along the way, not just the pieces falling off.
Right.
How to make that switch is, I think, just mostly a question of education. So there's no magic solution that I can think of. I built the website to help educate people because I think a lot of the reason for that way that things are set up now is people just didn't know in the past. But unfortunately, in government, things get ossified. And so they also get ossified in big pharma. So it takes a while to shift course. And that's what A4LI is partially for. Let me talk about the other big bottleneck is the regulatory aspect, right? There's not enough incentives in place because aging is not considered a disease. And there's much debate in the field about that. My own take on that is I think that there's enough resistance to considering aging a disease that should be treated or targetable for a clinical trial directly that I think that maybe that's not a fight worth fighting. But the individual subpathologies of aging, right? Aging isn't one thing. We know it's 5 to 15 individual subpathologies that have molecular definitions. And each one of those should really be considered to be a disease because each one of those has good science tying it directly to actual diseases and things that we would consider targetable clinical indications. There's no reason, most of those should either be a clinical indication or should be surrogate biomarkers. The measurement of them should be surrogate biomarkers. For example, the accumulation of persistent senescent cells, long-lived senescent cells, should be a targetable indication directly. The companies going after making senolytics shouldn't have to find individual diseases where senescent cells play a role. Once there's enough science built up showing that senescent cells lead to all these different diseases, it should be good enough to just demonstrate that you reduce the burden of senescent cells. Another one is thymus involution, right? So the thymus is where the T cells go to get trained. And I think I recently learned that's why the T cell is called the T cell. The T is for thymus. I don't know if that's true or not, but somebody said it. So that, like the liver, it goes through a very similar pathology of the liver with aging and it gets fatty and the actual functional tissue is reduced. That should be a clinically treatable, just like fatty liver disease is essentially a disease. We should have a, you know, thymus involution or fatty thymus disease as an indication that it should be treatable. Extracellular matrix crosslinks clearly lead to higher blood pressure. Higher blood pressure is a clinical target that we can go after. They lead to a bunch of other things. It should just, we just need to go back these steps and target these individual pathologies as indications. And that would create incentives to go after these faster. And it would really reduce the time it takes to get through clinical trials. And I think the case can be made for many of these individual subpathologies of aging that those are reasonable. I'm not well versed in exactly how new diseases come about as clinical indications, but I think exploring that, expanding that to include these subpathologies of aging would be a fruitful way to proceed from a regulatory improvement point of view.
I never actually thought about that, but that is a fascinating point, something that we might have to consider pushing for at A4LI. Carl, I want to give you one more second here to tell our audience how to find you and to give us some, I like to end these conversations by having our guest give our audience something to be hopeful for. And by that, can you tell us what gets you out of bed every morning? Is it the progress you're seeing in the aging field? Is there other things that really get you excited? What gets you out of bed every morning? What makes you hopeful for the future?
What gets me out of bed every morning is that whatever progress we make, if we make it one day earlier, that's 100 to 120,000 people who would die who maybe can live healthier a little bit longer, because that's how many people die per day. So that's reasons to be hopeful. So you can find me on Twitter at Carl Flegger, and on LinkedIn, just search my name and I'm there. I think the profile URL has Carl-R/Flegger. So it's got my middle initial in there. And on both platforms, I wrote a post not that long ago, which is linked from my pinned tweet or my profile on LinkedIn as one of the saved posts on my reasons for being optimistic about short to middle term progress in rejuvenation therapies. And it's a roundup of many of the areas that we just talked about, but talking about specific companies and what stage they're at, and you know why I'm hopeful that within 5 to 15 years, we'll see clinical trial progress because of the number of different companies that are in that area and are about to enter clinical trials or in clinical trials. And therefore, I think that there's a good chance that several of these areas, that 6 to 10 of these areas, might have meaningful progress within less than a generation, and that will help spur more funding for the field, and but also directly translate into helping a large number of people live that much healthier for a little bit longer.
Absolutely. We're waiting as a field for our ChatGPT moment. And once we have that, I think a flurry of funding and support will follow. But yeah, I think it's people like you that pushed it this far and are continuing to push it to get us to that point, right? It's like kind of the visionaries and the true believers that push us there. Carl, thank you so
much. It's possible that point might come in the next 5 to 10 years, or even in the next 1 to 3 years, depending on some of the current clinical trials on supplements.
Yeah, it's like getting a computer before. I guess I wasn't really alive then, so I don't really know. But it's like getting a computer. It's like getting a BlackBerry before everybody else did. We're getting into it early. I'm going to take that part out. Anyways, Carl, thank you so much for joining the HSPAN podcast. I really appreciate your time, and I think our audience appreciates the wisdom and you educating them on all things longevity industry on this podcast, and then also through your amazing website, agingbiotech.info. So Carl, thank you so much.
My pleasure, Dylan. Thanks for all the important work that you do.
Live long and prosper.
Thank you, Carl, for making the time to join us today. And for those of you listening at home, I hope you found this conversation as enlightening and informative as I did. If you have anyone you would like to see make an appearance on our podcast, you can send your suggestions to us at info@a4li.org. HSPAN will return in a couple of weeks, but until then, let's live long and prosper.